So, my name is Sikkar Nelin. I'm a first-year PhD student at the AIP in Potsdam. My supervisor sitting here in the front row, it's Katja. And I'm also advised by Martin Roth, and I have an awesome mentor, which is Sarah J. Schmidt. And I'm bringing you today some results from my first project, which is concerned with stellar magnetic evolution as viewed from flaring activity in K2 open clusters. So flares are very impressive. We can resolve them in great detail on the sun, as you can see here in UV light. But we like the physics, of course. So from a more physical picture, we think of flares as magnetic field arcades rising from the stellar surface into the corona, where we destabilize, where reconnection occurs, particles are accelerated downwards and particles emitted outwards, plasma is heated, and we observe magnetic radiation in all the different bands. For instance, we can do this in X-ray, as here in an XMM-Newton light curve, going from the pre-flare state step by step. Everything is quiet, and then suddenly the brightness increases dramatically when the reconnection occurs, and then the situation goes slowly back to the pre-flare state. We can see a fairly similar picture as you see in Allison's talk in Far UV in optical light, which is my work more or less, even infrared, famously recently so on TRAPPIST-1, down to radio bands. So now picture an M dwarf with an exoplanet in its orbit. And then consider a flare that occurs directed to that exoplanet. Now, in the scenario where you have a fairly active, young, I think it's an M4, I think it's GJ1243, 30 to 50 mega years old, and the exoplanet has unmagnetized, Earth-like atmosphere residing in the habitable zone, then a couple of recent models have suggested that atmospheric ozone can be lost irreversibly if these flares occur on a regular basis. But we know that this situation here is just a snapshot of the coevolution of planets and their host stars. So we know that at the same time, flaring age and mass are related. And just a selection of studies on that show that flaring activity is a function of galactic height. If you compare a young open cluster like M37 to field stars, you see a clear difference in flaring activity. If you look at white binaries, you see that their activity is consistent with each other because they have the same ages. And also a recent nice study that's called Every Flares, conducted by Ward Howard et al., has again shown what we all know, that flaring activity depends on spectral type and also again on galactic height. So my project is concerned with pinning down some more numbers on this flaring age mass relation, and this is how we did it. We took the Kepler satellite data. The Kepler satellite collected, high precision time resolve photometry, and as you can see here, a nice target pixel file with a flashy flare in the middle. From these target pixel files, we extract light curves and then detect superflares. And they're super because they're more energetic than everything you can observe on the sun. I'd like to mention at this point that a lot of open source software was involved. I designed my own little package that does the detection and characterization of flares in Kepler K2 and test light curves, which is itself based on other open source software, for instance, K2SC, George, and light curve. So now I have my light curves, and what I now do is go ahead and analyze light curves of thousands of stars in open clusters. And this is my sample. So on one axis you see the H, on the other axis the distance. I have here in the bottom left corner Pleiades, zero H main sequence, price EP, Hyades around 600 mega years. M35 is also zero H main sequence, but quite far away. And Rupert and Fund 47 bridges the gap at about 2.5 giga years to the solar age M67. They have some spread in metallicity. It's centered on solar. So I'm going ahead with this, and then I take each of my open clusters and split them up in effective temperature bins. And then I go into each effective temperature bin, take all the light curves, find all the flares in them, find all the energies of these flares, and then I go count them. What I get is, what Allison mentioned already, is a cumulative flare frequency distribution bin by effective temperature. So what you see here is, on one axis, equivalent duration, which is a proxy for flare energy, measured in how long does a star have to shine in order to release just as much energy as a flare. And on the y-axis, you see a flare frequency in flares per year. Each diamond in this plot represents one contribution from one flare. Here, in the Pleiades, in the effective temperature bin between 2,500 and 3,000 Kelvin. So for comparison spectral types here. Now, we know from microflares on the sun to superflares on low-mass stars that this relation can be modeled by a power law with an exponent about roughly minus one. If I go and let loose that exponent, I get weird results, like the dashed line can result like for some maximum likelihood estimators. But I know that my sample sizes for my different temperature bins sometimes are just too small to, say, be a good data sample to constrain the power law components. So I thought, well, let's just go ahead with what seems to be consensus among like orders of magnitude and just fit the minus one power law. And now I'm going to step through all of my temperature bins and all of my open clusters and show you what I get in that case. So if I go to somewhat higher temperatures, I can add Hyades, Prasipi. These fall somewhat below the Pleiades in the frequency space, in the frequency. And then I go to the next higher temperature bins. Picture is pretty similar. But then at the next higher up bin, my Prasipi bin falls down and the frequency decreases. Next bin, the whole situation, the whole activity declines in both in the zero-H mean sequence cluster and in the 600 megayears cluster. Similar thing where M35 takes over the role of the zero-H mean sequence cluster, and finally, Ruprecht 147 at 2.5 gigayears falls way down below. Now, as I've told you, the power law description is now constrained, and my only free parameter is y-intercept, so call this beta 2. Now I can go to the next level of abstraction and just plot beta 2 versus h. And this is what I get. So h on one axis, beta 2 on the other axis. Here's high flaring rates, here's low flaring rates at the bottom. And there's a lot of interesting things, I believe, to say and to discuss about this plot. For the moment, I just want to mention two things. First of all, that you see that in each individual effective temperature bin, activity declines with age. But secondly, it does so faster for the higher mass stars. An interesting point is this the lowest mass bin in the universe. I think I've written down at least five different conceivable explanations for why this falls like below what we would expect it. And the other question you might want to ask is, where the hell is M67? Like you promised, and I actually, I did not forget. I have studied like several thousand light curves, especially those from the crowded region, detrended by Nardiello et al. 2016, and I found one flare, and I dedicated a whole poster to it. So if you're interested, you can go visit find out on the frequency of super Carrington flares in the solar H cluster M67. For now, I want you only to take home from this talk that flaring activity declines with age. This decline is slower for low-mass stars. And we have now found a way to quantify this flaring H-mass relation using long baseline, high cadence light curves from K2. Consequence of this is, well, we should factor flares into exoplanetary evolution models. And now we also have some handle on it. Bottom line, better flaring stars, better planets. And I'll take questions, but please talk slowly to me because I'm very jet-lagged, kind of brain slow.
Okay, questions? We'll do the first right up here and then second in the back.
So that was very interesting. So the M35 and Pleiades open clusters also show some bifurcation in the periods of their stars. So there are the stars that spin as one would expect from magnetic braking and those that spin way faster. Did you look to see if there is any correlation between the flares and the spin rate of the stars on those open clusters?
I've not done so personally, yeah. But it's...
If you measured age, not in a constant years, but normalized it by the main sequence lifetime, which is much longer, of course, for these smaller stars, how would the smaller stars be flaring? How would the evolution in flares depend on stellar mass or spectral type?
I'm not sure if I actually understand
The small stars change their flaring behavior much less rapidly than the large stars. They also age much less rapidly. And if you divided out the difference in how long they age, their main sequence lifetime, how would the flaring decrease compare? Would that account for the difference in the decrease with spectral
type? I've not precisely quantified that. One idea to go about is maybe this one. So this is just a pre-main sequence lifetime. For the lowest mass spin, it can amount to like 2.5 gigayears. So if you're looking to my sample, I believe that for many of my stars, we are not even talking main sequence yet. So but you can try to divide by.
So that's a good point. What about if you normalized by how long it takes them to get to the main sequence?
That's a good question. I should actually do that.
Anna.
Excellent talk. I was curious about the coolest temperature bin. You see a drop in their flare frequency rates. Is it comparable to the drop in the flaring rates, say, in the field when you go from, say, mid-M dwarfs to late-M dwarfs, when you get to cooler temperatures? Is it essentially a reflection of that temperature drop, or is it a different scale?
Well, as I said, I believe there's so many things that can factor in. So if you want to know why I'm hesitant about giving an answer here, is that in that single data point, they go, the assumption that my minus one exponent is still valid, which might not be true if you go to not fully ionized stellar atmospheres, then it may well be that the color temperature relations that I apply fail. And they diverge, and I believe some of them that I used, I used them in like the ranges that are suggested by the office of the corresponding papers, but I see them diverge like from each other. It may be, in fact, physical, of course, that these are still spinning up and that actually they would peak somewhere else and then decline like the others. And then you also have binarity effects, which would like not change this data point, but set down all the others, because I would have more companions flaring in the hotter temperature bins, and also the temperature of the actual flares that go into my energies. So I'm very hesitant about making any suggestions.
Okay, I don't see any other hands up, so I will ask one last question, and if the next speaker could set up during that. So you said you're building tools that are flexible to work with K2 and TESS. There are lots of young moving groups that are kind of 10 to 200 million years old that will get 10 series of time for TESS. Are you planning to look at those?
Yeah, I have had a look at like what open clusters fall in there, and there's certainly a number of them, especially going to going from 30-minute cadence, what all of this is, to 2-minute cadence is making my life very much easier. So yeah.
Have you looked at any of them yet, or is that the next step?
It's probably the next step. But I have run a couple of test-like curves, and like it works. Let's see if I can. Like it depends on how many stars we get in these moving groups in the right.
Yes. All right. So. Great. Let's thank Ekaterina again.